It was just a couple of generations ago that we were talking about a population explosion, one that looked like it would outgrow our ability to feed all the people on the planet. And while there is hunger in parts of the world all the time, we have more than 7 billion people, and the food supply is more or less keeping up. Beyond food, there are other ways in which we have slowed our consumption of resources while adding consumers all the time. Andrew McAfee shows us how in a book called More From Less, long subtitle, The Surprising Story of How We Learn to Prosper Using Fewer Resources and What Happens Next. Andrew McAfee works at MIT as a research scientist and as co-founder and co-director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy. He's written several previous books and appeared on the Ideas Circuit through events like TED Talks. Andrew McAfee, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So you say America is post-peak in its exploitation of the Earth. Post-peak in what sense?
Just about all the senses that matter. So here are a couple that I can think of that matter a great deal. The amount of resources we take from the Earth. And America now, year by year, takes fewer tons of steel, gallons of water, acres of cropland, pounds of fertilizer, all these different material inputs to the economy. We now take less of them year by year. We're also polluting less in just about all the ways that matter. Our greenhouse gas emissions are trending downward. Now, they're not trending downward quickly enough, and I'm sure we'll talk more about global warming, but pollution in general is much, much lower than it used to be. And after driving several species to the brink of extinction, or even beyond, the passenger pigeon is now extinct because of us, we are finally letting a lot of these species come back and repopulate. The U.S. bison herd has something about 500,000 animals on it now, after being down to probably fewer than 1,000 right around the turn of the 20th century. So when I say we're exploiting the Earth less, I mean in just about all the big ways that matter.
Well, so you're talking about less resource use per capita. Have we gotten to that point?
Beyond that point. So I'm talking about less resource use by all Americans put together. And the magnitude of the reversal is actually pretty big. Since the early 1980s, for example, we have given an amount of farmland back to nature equal in size to the state of Washington. This is a big, big change. And so forests can regrow on that land. The birds can come back to that land. We're not using it anymore.
I'm surprised the phone didn't ring off the hook, though, when you were talking about extinctions, though, because we have a fair number of people who do call the program on a regular basis and talk about the fact that we're in a mass extinction right now across the world.
There is the potential, if we keep on heating the planet, for a mass extinction to go on. However, you don't see evidence of that happening yet. The rate of observed extinctions for lots of different kinds of species has actually slowed down. And I am not saying that there's nothing to worry about. I hope that never comes across. But it's also true that as we humans have gone around the world, we have created new species. The animals that have come along with this have hybridized, they've speciated, they've created new species. So yes, we are changing the world. It is not the case that all of those changes are always only in the bad direction.
All right. You know, you point out that we have more digital goods, and that leads to some dematerializing where we seem to have fewer needs. But the fact is, when I think about all the things that we think of as necessary, particularly in our kitchens, for example, it seems like we have maybe reduced on one hand but increased on the other.
And you would think that, and it's called the rebound effect, in that if we economize in one place, we just make up for that and overuse resources somewhere else. As things get more efficient, the old thinking goes, we just use more and more of those things in more and more places. If that were true, then we would not be using fewer tons of steel and copper and nickel and less fertilizer and less water and less cropland. We are actually getting more from less overall throughout the entire economy.
All right. Now, again, you're saying that there's not nothing to worry about. You're not saying things are good enough for that matter. But you do offer, rather than the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the four horsemen of optimism. And who would those be?
Yeah. So the four horsemen of the optimist, to me, come in two pairs. And the first one is the pair that lets us reduce our overall resource use. And that pair is technological progress, which lets us collapse a lot of devices down into a smartphone, and what I call capitalism, or ruthless competition in a market. Companies that don't face any competition don't care about lowering their costs. They can just pass all their costs on to their customers. Companies that have a lot of rivals that are locked in really nasty battles, they care greatly about every opportunity to reduce their costs. They have to take advantage of all those opportunities because of the competition. So when you put that competition together with really fantastic technologies, we start to lighten our resource footprint on the planet. But I'm not just here to cheerlead for capitalism and tech progress. The other two horsemen of the optimist are equally important, and they are public awareness of the fact, for example, that pollution is not just an annoyance, it's a terrible health hazard, or public awareness of the fact that we're killing all the whales over the course of the 20th century, and it's desperately important that we not do that, that we change course. And when you combine public awareness with what I call responsive government, and that basically just means governments that listen to the will of their people and put in place good measures to do what the people want, when you have capitalism and tech progress and public awareness and responsive government, when all four horsemen ride together, I kind of sit back and expect us to improve both the human condition and the state of the natural world over time.
The book is called More From Less, The Surprising Story of How We Learned to Prosper Using Fewer Resources and What Happens Next. It is an optimistic book, as we already mentioned. We're talking about the four horsemen of optimism. So it starts from a positive place. You can challenge that if you like. We'll come back and talk more with Andrew McAfee. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Andrew McAfee from MIT. He's the co-founder, co-director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy. He studies how digital economies change business, the economy, and society. His latest book is called More From Less, The Surprising Story of How We Learn to Prosper Using Fewer Resources and What Happens Next. So the dire predictions of the past about being too many people and not enough resources haven't come to pass as of yet. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So about those dire predictions from the past, Thomas Robert Malthus, who beat Paul Ehrlich in dire population predictions by nearly 200 years, remind us about Malthus.
Yeah, Malthus was the first person that offered a really gloomy prediction about the course of human history. And he gives us the adjective Malthusian for pretty good reasons, because he said in the late 18th century, essentially, most of us are going to starve, and there's nothing we can do about it. And his point was that human population tends to increase, we say, geometrically or exponentially. You know, 2 people, 4 people, 8 people, 16 people. And he said our ability to produce food only increases arithmetically or linearly, 2, 3, 4, 5. He essentially said, do the math. That doesn't look very pretty for us. And my community uses the adjective Malthusian as an insult these days about pessimistic and really, really wrong. The crazy thing, though, is that Malthus was a terrible forecaster. He was not a bad historian, because when you look back at the episodes of human history before the 18th century, you see exactly what he was talking about. We have really good evidence, for example, about prosperity and population in England for several centuries before 1800, and the only time there were a lot of English is when they were all really poor, and the only time they were prosperous was when there weren't very many of them. But the reason we use Malthus as an insult now, instead of somebody who was really insightful, is the Industrial Revolution happened and put humanity on a completely different trajectory, where population and prosperity increased at the same time. They both increased like we have never, ever seen before, and we really did enter a new chapter of human history. So Malthus's gloominess might have been historically accurate. It was a terrible forecast.
But about that past analysis, here's a momentary timeout to ask about data from the past. I mean, how can we know that, for example, there were 5 million people on the planet 10,000 years ago?
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
People have done beautiful work to essentially excavate the past, excavate the demographics of humanity over a long period of time, excavate the economies of societies that have vanished forever and ever. And there's this wonderful stream of decades-long research that largely converges on this notion about how quickly populations grew, and you can use a bunch of different tools to help you understand that, and affluence, or the size of economies, or how prosperous people were. We have bizarrely good magnifying glasses to see deep in the past. Not perfect, of course, but strangely good.
Okay, so now back to Malthus, the original Malthusian. Give an example of a technology that he missed that changed the world in a way that he couldn't anticipate or didn't anticipate.
And I didn't understand this before I started working on the book, because when I started researching More for Less, I didn't really get how the Industrial Revolution, how steam engines helped us feed more people. I understood how they would help us make more iron or, you know, make more textiles, but how do they help us feed more people? And the answer is fertilizer. It turns out there were huge deposits of fertilizer in South America, both in deserts and on islands offshore where bird droppings called guano had been accumulating for thousands of years. We knew this was really good fertilizer. It was just extremely inefficient to go get that raw material from South America, convert it into fertilizer in England, and then distribute it out to farms all around the country and all around the continent. Steam power helped with every bit of that. We sent steamships down to South America. We brought back the raw materials. We converted them into fertilizer in factories. We put the fertilizer on steam-powered trains and drove them all over Europe. And the Malthusian oscillations, these Malthusian famines, stopped forever. And then, of course, all kinds of other things happened. We did build railroads and steamships, and we massively increased the ability to produce iron and textiles and just about everything else. But the heart of the Industrial Revolution is a story about feeding more people and using fertilizer to do it.
Andrew McAfee is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is More From Less, the surprising story of how we learn to prosper using fewer resources and what happens next. So steam engines, faster people, faster productivity, farms got more productive, new industries sprang up, workers eventually made more money. Steam then gave way to internal combustion and electricity, but along the way we pretty much pounded the planet, didn't we?
We pounded the planet in a couple different important ways. The first one, maybe the most obvious, we just took more resources from it every year. We took more coal out of the ground when we got the internal combustion engine. We took more oil out of the ground year after year to feed this constantly growing economy. We chopped down trees all over the world, first for fuel and then to make way for cropland. And we took metals out, and we took fertilizer, we took minerals out. We used more water year after year. We just kind of, you know, ate up the world more and more every year. The two other things that we did to our planet are we polluted it more year after year. And for a long time, we thought of pollution as a nuisance and a price you paid for industrialization and for growth. And then the third category of abuse of our planet was we drove many animals to the brink of extinction or beyond. The passenger pigeon is not with us anymore. James Audubon saw a flight of passenger pigeons early in the 19th century that took 3 days to pass overhead. They were all gone by 1914. We almost wiped out the bison in North America. We almost wiped out whales in almost all of the world's oceans. So we need to be honest that the industrial era was this period of amazing increases in human prosperity, while, like you point out, we beat up on our planet more year after year. And the way I think about Earth Day and the dawn of the environmental movement, Earth Day, the first Earth Day was in 1970, was people rising up and saying, stop, we cannot keep doing this. We have to take better care of the planet that we all live on. And I'm intensely grateful to the environmental movement for saying that at that time.
And while we're on the subject of passenger pigeons and other creatures gone from the face of the earth, I want to bring in a phone call from Pam in Dexter, who wants to talk about this very topic. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew McAfee.
Hi, am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay, I heard a beep, but anyways, well, I you know, I appreciate being positive and upbeat because I know that from after 25 years of working on these issues, people don't really, they get, when you feel depressed about something and it just seems like it's getting worse, it's hard to become active. So I can appreciate that. But I also think that it's important that we realize that this is a crisis on many levels. It's the global warming crisis. It's the toxins in the environment crisis. It's the destruction of wildlife habitat crisis. Too many humans using too many resources. We aren't lessening our use of resources, unfortunately, because there's more and more people. So I think it's important that we really look at the situation as extreme, and it is a crisis. The Earth's carrying capacity, from what I have heard, we're using 3 to 5 times what the Earth can restore. So it's not that, oh, yeah, we have water coming out of our faucet right now, some of us, some people don't right now in other parts of the world. But we're using up the future. The aquifers are being depleted. The Central Valley aquifer in California is quickly being depleted, and that's like one of the breadbaskets of the world. So while it might appear that everything is normal, the edges are crumbling around us. And one of the things that really annoys me when I talk to, I've called this show before, and it was somebody talking about climate change, and I said, you know, nobody ever talks about using less. And the American lifestyle is not up for negotiation. Well, we do need to use less energy and resources and shop less. And the whole system has to do a 180. And unfortunately, we only have 5 to 10 years to turn this around. And so just today there was an article in the paper about the barred owls. And
about the barred owls being shot to make room for the spotted owls, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like we're always blaming the other species. Oh, well, the reason why is because the habitat is getting smaller and smaller. So the spotted owls are competing with the barred owls are competing with the spotted owls. The sea lions are eating the salmon.
Right. So Pam, let's
the wolves are eating the livestock. Well, that's all because of the habitat loss. So I want to be positive, and I know as an activist that's what gets people excited is when we see positive changes, but it is a crisis, and this is dire. And so please, can you talk a little bit about the fierce urgency of now and for people to wake up? And I'll listen on the radio.
All right. Thanks, Pam. Appreciate that. Andrew?
Yeah, and I do want to instill a sense of urgency. I share that sense of urgency, but let's channel it. Let's be realistic about it. We are cooking the planet, and we need to stop. And our urgent homework for the 21st century is to deal with the air pollution of greenhouse gases. But I am not as pessimistic as I think our caller was about a lot of the other phenomena. There are parts of the world where habitat is being destroyed. Absolutely. When you look at the rich world, you notice this very interesting difference. Forest land is increasing over time. As I pointed out, we've given an amount of cropland back to nature in America equal in size to the state of Washington. That's habitat that's available for animals to come back in. Globally, we are protecting more and more of the Earth's surface and the ocean as parks, both marine parks and terrestrial parks. So there's this very interesting difference in low-income countries. The exploitations of the planet are still increasing. In high-income countries, they are not. We've reversed course in most of the ways that matter. My conclusion from this is really straightforward. Let's help the rest of the world become rich. I'm with Indira Gandhi, who said in 1972, poverty is the greatest polluter. Great. Let's get rid of that poverty. We will take better care of the Earth as a result. I don't believe that affluence is the enemy of the Earth. I believe poverty is where our real problems come from. And our caller talked about 5 or 10 years. I've been hearing that for the past 50 years. I've been hearing that since the first Earth Day, and these arguments that we have a very short amount of time before whatever dire emergency kicks in. I just don't think those arguments have held up very well. Now, I do want to say this one more time. Human-caused global warming is real, and it's bad, and we need to deal with it, and we're not doing a good enough job of dealing with it. But when we think about greenhouse gases as air pollution, the recipe, the playbook for dealing with it becomes very clear, because we have effectively, very effectively dealt with air pollution in America and the rest of the rich world over the past half century. The skies in American cities are, I believe, more than 90% cleaner than they were 50 years ago. So we know the playbook.
Andrew McAfee is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy. His latest book is More from Less, the surprising story of how we learn to prosper using fewer resources and what happens next. If this is a conversation you'd like to join, give us a call, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's continue on that thread about Earth Day, the first in 1970. There was certainly optimism that they were finally paying attention on one hand, but you had Paul Ehrlich in that period of history, who we referenced earlier, who was the modern-day Malthus.
Yeah, and Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb in 1968, and I think the opening phrases of that book were something like, hundreds of millions of people are going to die from starvation, and there's nothing we can do about it. And what he and some other authors said was, mass famines are inevitable in the future, and in the rich world, the food exporting world, we have to make tough choices about which countries we're even going to try to save versus which ones we're not. Okay, let's look at what's happened in the 50 years since those kinds of books came out. Global population has increased a little bit slower than forecast around 1970, but global population has increased by several billion people in that 50-year space of time. On average, those people are living longer, they are much healthier, and they are much better fed than they were in 1970. As recently as about the 80s, I think, the average person in the world didn't have access to 2,500 calories a day. And that's an important benchmark because that's about the number required to keep an active adult male at the same body weight. So it's kind of an important benchmark. Every region in the world now is providing its average person with at least 2,500 calories. So this notion that population growth is going to cause dire shortages and famines, we have to walk away from that kind of thinking. It's just demonstrably wrong. The future is not going to be that different than the past 50 years. I think it's going to be exactly in the optimistic direction.
So we had Paul Ehrlich on one hand talking about mass famine and not being able to feed the people of the planet. There was a contrasting view back then from Julian Simon. How did he see the future?
Yeah, and Julian Simon is really one of my intellectual heroes because he said something that was really unpopular, really counterintuitive, and I think evidence shows he was dead flat right. And what Simon said was shortages of resources or food or anything else are actually not something that we need to worry about, which sounds crazy when you first hear it. Of course we need to worry about these things. What Simon said was when a shortage appears, we can all agree that prices for whatever, you know, whatever it's nickel or chromium or wheat or whatever, prices are going to go up. And what Simon said was that rise in prices is going to cause two things to happen. First of all, people are going to go look around the world like crazy for more of that resource because they can make money if they find it. And second of all, they're going to look for substitutes for that resource. So if nickel becomes really expensive, we'll find other metals that will get the job done. What Simon said was that one or both of those efforts will succeed, the price will go back down, the shortage will ease, and we're not going to need to worry about that. And I want to stress, doesn't that sound somewhere between counterintuitive and crazy? The thing to keep in mind, again, over the past 50 years, while we've added so many people to the planet, we were so worried about shortages and famines, the affordability, the availability of the world's average person to afford any resource that we care about on the planet, the affordability of every resource has increased a great deal over that same period of time. So what I don't like is this view that the 7.7 billion people on the planet now are these passive mouths that just want to be fed. I find that insulting, actually. Those 7.7 billion people are also problem solvers. They're ingenious. They're innovative. They're entrepreneurial. They will go out there and figure out what needs to be solved and go work on those challenges. And the track record of meeting those challenges is quite a good track record.
There's a story in your book that I'd never heard before that apparently Julian Simon and Paul Ehrlich got into a bet.
They made a bet, yeah. They went back and forth after Ehrlich wrote his book and Simon wrote his response. They went back and forth for a while, and then they finally agreed in 1980 on a bet. And Simon offered pretty generous terms to Ehrlich. He said, "We, you and I can both agree that shortages are going to cause prices to rise. You think the coming shortages are going to be permanent? I don't. Pick your time frame, pick the resources that we're going to track, And if at the end of the time frame, the real price of those resources has risen, I will pay you the difference. If the real price has fallen, you will pay me the difference. I think Ehrlich thought he was getting a sucker's bet. So he picked five resources that he thought were sure to be scarce over the next decade, and he picked a decade for the duration of the bet. The real price of all five resources had fallen. In total, the price of that bundle of five resources had fallen by more than half. So Ehrlich made good on the bet. He mailed Simon a check, but he didn't include any note or explanation with the check, and he didn't talk very much about that bet in the years afterward. And one thing that I'm doing, as More From Less comes out, I'm offering updated versions of those bets. If you are still a Malthusian, if you're still a pessimist, I've posted bets at the Long Now website. I say, for example, that America is going to use less energy in 10 years than it does today. It's going to use less cropland and less fertilizer in 10 years than it does today. If you think I'm being too optimistic, great, let's bet.
All right, back with more of Andrew McAfee and his book More From Less on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the future and what it looks like, and we're getting a more optimistic view than perhaps you hear from a lot of people, from Andrew McAfee, who is the co-founder, co-director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy, looking at how digital operations and computers change the economy around us. Andrew McAfee's got a pretty optimistic view of the future, and he reflects it in a book called More From Less, The Surprising Story of How We Learn to Prosper Using Fewer Resources and What Happens Next. You're welcome to join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to pick up on what you were saying about that bet. You said at the Long Now website, is that Long Now Foundation?
If you go to the Long Now Foundation, or if you just go to longbets.com, I can't remember if it's com or org, but if you just type in Long Bets, you'll get there pretty quickly. And one of my bets is on the homepage right now.
Okay. So there's the Long Now Foundation, longbets.org. Let's see. Yep, there it is. Long Bets, the arena for accountable predictions, longbets.org. So let's come back to the basic issue here about you say that resource use is declining and that that's why the prices of resources are declining. Is this not, though, like George W. Bush talking about carbon intensity? He talks about reducing per capita measurements, but when you get more capitas, you still are increasing your resource use, aren't you?
If that were the case, yes. But the dematerialization in America is what we call absolute dematerialization. In other words, it's not dematerialization per capita. It's less resource use by all Americans put together. So we're growing our economy. We're growing our population now, but we're using fewer tons of steel in aggregate year after year. Less timber, less paper, less water for agriculture, less fertilizer, less cropland. We're just reducing our physical footprint on the planet. Again, not per person, but all Americans put together. I would be able to say more things about the rest of the world, but the evidence is not as high quality. It doesn't go back as far. Another researcher found the same phenomenon happening in the United Kingdom, and it looks like some of the same things are happening in Europe. So when we look at the richest, the most technologically advanced countries, it looks like we're either absolutely post-peak now, or we're getting there quite quickly. The big question is, how quickly can we get the rest of the world to join us on this trend?
So you point out, though, that the idea that came to the acronym CRIB, consume less, recycle, impose limits, back to the land, you say these are not the reasons that our resource use dropped.
Yeah, that's right. Around Earth Day, we heard a lot of advice about how to take better care of the planet, and I summarized those strategies with the acronym CRIB. Consume less, recycle, impose limits because people won't voluntarily stop consuming, or just go back to the land, turn your back on this technologically sophisticated economy. And I try to make clear in the book, those are not the reasons that we are dematerializing. We continue to grow. Our economy continues to grow. Most Americans have not renounced consumption and becoming more affluent over time. Recycling is a real phenomenon, but that's different than dematerialization. They're just separate phenomenon. We have not imposed limits. There's no board that decides how many tons of steel America can use every year. And the Back to the Land movement had a little momentum for a while, but it petered out, and we are a densely urbanized, technologically sophisticated population now.
So you give credit to technology and to capitalism. We've talked about capital. We'll talk about it more in the minutes ahead. But how about some concrete examples of ways in which we're able to consume more and yet use less material?
There's a newspaperman, a retired newsman in Buffalo, who loved to wander around that city, go to yard sales, and see if he could find interesting things about Buffalo's past. And he bought a stack of Buffalo News newspapers from the early 90s, and he went flipping through them. And he found a Radio Shack ad from 1991. And then he noticed that there were 15 separate physical devices on that Radio Shack ad from 1991. And he said, 13 out of the 15 of these have disappeared into the smartphone that's in my pocket and your pocket right now. And I looked at the ad. He reproduced the ad. And there's a big camcorder on it, and there's a fax machine on it, and there's a scanner on it, and there's a portable tape recorder on it, there's an answering machine on it, and there's a film camera on it. You just go down the list. And sure enough, I have access to all those things, and I have them on a device that weighs much less than a pound and uses very few comparative resources. I think if you took those 13 devices and put them on one side of a balance and put my smartphone on the other, it would not even be close. So to me, that's one of just the most vivid examples of this broad technological phenomenon of dematerialization and letting us get more from less. I am much happier with my music consumption now than I was in the era of the AM/FM radio, than I was in the era of the CD player. I have access to more music. I probably listen to more music. And I have access to all the music that I want, when I want, with good recommendations. That's more. That's just better. But a lot fewer resources, a lot fewer molecules go into satisfying that demand.
Let's take another phone call. We have Hope on the line from Honeydew, California. Honeydew between Bull Creek and Petrolia. Go ahead, Hope.
Oh, hi. So I'm sort of dumbfounded. I mean, the reason our air is cleaner is we send all of our dirty industry to third world countries. And the reason we use less fertilizer is there's more imported foods. It's really incredible when you shop, if you really look at the labels, how much stuff comes from China and South America. And with the smartphone thing, now it's you need to have a new car every year, a new smartphone every year. Everything has to be new every year because that's how it's supposed to be. I mean, I don't do that, but this is doublespeak. I can't believe it.
Okay,
I can't
thanks.
Believe somebody from MIT could come up with stuff like this. It's like crazy. And I'll stop now. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Hope, for the call. Appreciate that. So here's a chance to defend yourself, Andrew.
Yeah, and Hope points out that globalization is a real phenomenon, and it would be easy in a lot of ways to say that the reason we're experiencing these things in the rich world is, as she says, we've offloaded our production, and we've offloaded our pollution to the rest of the world. That's not true. America is still a manufacturing powerhouse, for example. We get confused because China has surpassed us as the world's biggest manufacturer. We're number two, and our manufacturing industries grow every year. And I found pretty good research when I was writing the book. These researchers found that not only do our manufacturing industries grow, they are about as dirty as they were in the past. So we have not outsourced all of our pollution to China. We can't outsource our driving cars or generating electricity to China. And those were both major sources of air pollution as well. So that argument about globalization just doesn't hold up for pollution, for air pollution at all. And yet, the skies over America's air pollution is less than 10% of what it was 50 years ago. It's an amazing triumph of an aware public and very smart regulation. The Clean Air Act, the subsequent amendments to the Clean Air Act, have been massively important. She also brings up imported food. America is a net food exporter. And there's a graph in my book, More From Less, where I look not at food imports and exports and the balance there, but just the total tonnage of crops produced year after year in America. That number essentially goes up every year. We're an agricultural powerhouse. We grow more tons, physically, tonnage of crops year after year. We do it now using fewer tons of fertilizer, fewer gallons of water, and fewer acres of land. There's no other explanation for this phenomena than a productivity, than a technology story. Globalization doesn't work as an explanation for that.
So we mentioned that we were going to get back to a discussion of capitalism in your defense of that. And I think that is where Phil in Eureka wants to go. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew McAfee.
Oh, thank you. It's a great program. I enjoy listening to your guest. The question I had was, for example, I'm pondering the fact that, you know, I kind of think that universal health care, like the other industrialized countries have, would be the appropriate thing in our country as well. But that would be not-for-profit health care in terms of how you're covered by it. I was wondering what your guest thought about that, and also what he thought about socialism as a form of government with the people versus capitalism. I'll take his answer off the air.
And those are addressed in the book. Thanks for that.
And Jeffrey, you know the definition of a great question when you ask an author is one that they've devoted an entire chapter to in the book. Capitalism is a triggering word for a lot of people, and there's nobody who's indifferent to the concept. It's got these huge cheerleaders, and it's got people who really think that it's a terrible system of oppression. To our caller's points, one of the things I say in the book is that all of the world's rich countries today are capitalist by my definition. And I go through the definition in some detail. What it essentially means is that most goods and services come from companies as opposed to anything else. Now, our caller points out, healthcare is an exception in most rich countries. I think America should move much closer to other rich countries in that regard. But when you look at the GDP of Sweden, for example, most of it comes from companies. All rich companies have free-floating prices. The government doesn't set prices. Property rights and contracts are respected. And there's this phenomenon called voluntary exchange. You can't make me buy a product or sign a contract if I don't want to. All those things are true for Norway, Denmark, Spain, America, Canada. The rich world has all of these things. They differ in their social safety nets, absolutely. But if you want a real contrast, look at a truly socialist country, which is Venezuela, where under Chavez and then Maduro, the government took over many companies and many industries. They established prices. There was a government price. They took away private property from a lot of people. They eroded the courts. They started supplying free food because they could subsidize it because of oil prices to a lot of low-income people instead of letting the market do it. And they essentially followed the socialism playbook. Now, they did a particularly bad job of it in a lot of ways, but they followed the classic socialist playbook, and the people of Venezuela have suffered immensely as a result. I think somewhere more than 80% of the population now lives in poverty, and there's a humanitarian crisis. It's the largest migration of people we've seen in peacetime out of that country. This is why I'm an ardent capitalist.
Let's take another call. We've got enough time to take a call from Tony in Talent. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. Yes, I agree with you about capitalism. I'm wondering about, I haven't heard all of the show, but Paul Ehrlich was on this program, actually. He was invited a few years ago. And people were calling in and saying that he was predicting the future correctly. Really, somebody who had read Thomas Malthus 100 years before knew that he was up the creek with that thinking. And the famous bet with Simon, I read about that 20 years ago when I read Bjørn Lomborg's book. There's every reason for optimism. This I don't know why it is, but what is it about the human nature that wants to believe everything is going to hell in a handbasket?
Negativity bias, perhaps. Thanks for the question, Tony. Andrew, what do you say?
I say there's a great deal of negativity bias, and I think it has a lot of sources. We do have an innate human negativity bias because bad news is more vivid to us. It sticks in our brains longer. Journalists and the media realize this. It's why a lot of the stories we hear are negative stories. And when I hang around with people who work at very elite universities, it sometimes seems like there's a competition as to who can be the most pessimistic. If you make an optimistic argument, you can be considered a little bit of an intellectual lightweight in some ways. So like our caller points out, I'm really grateful to people like Bjorn Lomborg, who went out and wrote The Skeptical Environmentalist a bunch of years ago and started making this much more evidence-based, optimistic case. I'm intensely grateful to Steve Pinker, who wrote Enlightenment Now and started documenting these trends. He very nicely provided an endorsement for More from Less, and I want to join this tribe of people who are based in evidence. And once you do that, as opposed to a crystal ball that's as dark and dour as you can make it, I think evidence is what compels you toward optimism, not in every sense. And the book, I go into some detail about the areas where we still have work ahead of us, but I do think the evidence compels you to a much more optimistic view of our trajectory.
Only got about 30 seconds left, Andrew. What about the lid on population? Do you think we're going to get to 9 million and then begin to decline from there?
The demographics say that we're going to hit peak humanity sometime between 2050 and 2100, after which there are just going to be fewer human beings on the planet. We're going to get over that hump. We're going to become one more species on the planet. If we deal with global warming effectively, that's a big if, but if we do that, we're going to live in a much, much better balance, in a much lighter balance with nature than we are right now.
Very optimistic book. It is called More from Less, The Surprising Story of How We Learned to Prosper Using Fewer Resources and What Happens Next. It's the work of Andrew McAfee, who is the co-founder, co-director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure. That'll do it for today's exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Jeff Exchange. The program is produced by John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Our student assistant, Randy Babbitt, is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day.